All right, is that everybody? Yep. Welcome everyone. On what for many of us is quite a hot evening. Except for the couple people for whom it is tomorrow. Welcome. Now, Kathy, Gainon, please forgive my brain fart. Where do I know you from again? If you would unmute yourself.
I mute myself for politeness and then I forget to unmute. I have attended the Tuesday evenings at the Brightway location sporadically. Okay. I'm not regular, but I'm occasional, and I usually have dry hair and no reading glasses.
Okay. Okay. I knew I recognized you. Certainly recognized your Dharma name. So, all right. So I will go around and say hi to everyone to begin. So obviously, Gainon and Marvin, Bob K, Gaffel, Mark in Australia, Mark in Aloha, Sam, Susan, Franklin, Matt, Shoketsu, Fanus from Iran, Jeff, Shri, Bridget, Drew, and Ruth Ann. So, welcome everyone. Trying to think of any announcements. I guess we had a one-day retreat scheduled in August, which will not be in person as planned, not surprisingly, but we will do a online retreat that day. So go ahead and check the calendar. Lisa, our newsletter person and website person, will be, I don't know, I'm not sure if that calendar event has been updated yet, but pretty soon it will be with like the schedule that we'll be following. We did one of these, I think in April, and it was very sweet. It's like doing retreat together also in your home. So it kind of was a nice mix of Sangha support and practice, but also being within your own life. Any other announcements that people can think of that I should say? Anything coming up? Right. Cool. So tonight we are continuing with Uchiyama Roshi's How to Cook Your Life from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment, focused on the Tenzo Kyokan, but you know, each chapter pretty much stands on its own as well. He refers to Dogen's instructions to the cook, but tonight we're talking about chapter 4, Everything You Encounter Is Your Life. So I wanted to not put you on the spot, but if any of you did read this chapter ahead of time, and if you have any questions or parts of it that really liked, that you would like to read a little bit of or share, just wanted to open it up.
I have to run, go get my book.
This is the chapter with all the little diagrams of people. That's kind of cute.
I can read, I mean, it's probably a part that a lot of people marked or noticed, but it's on page 43. Regardless of where we might find ourselves, there is only the self, which is always the self. Hence the expression, Yuga Dokuson, I alone am revered in heaven and earth. The world is not some entity which exists apart from us. The world is where we function. Likewise, the life of the true self is not some entity apart from our functioning and working. Everything we encounter is our life.
So there was something that I guess I had more of a question about, and I was just curious what people thought about it. So on page 42, I think it's the last, well, second to last paragraph, or maybe the sentence before that is more relevant to Buddhist teaching focus on our absolute self and place the greatest emphasis on the unique and fresh quality of life. Just what is this fresh and vibrant quality of the life of this absolute self? One thing we can be sure of is that we will never discover it in the world of trading and exchanging with others. The true self has nothing to do with others. It is a self that lives totally within itself. The world as experienced in the world, The world as experienced is the world which the self alone, you alone, can experience. So for me that, I think I understand what he's getting at, but in my mind, I kept thinking about how in many religions, and I would say even true in Buddhism, there's this notion of selflessness and this idea that as we give more to others, that in some ways that is kind of the true, in quotes, path to some form of enlightenment. So I guess for me, there's a contradiction there.
I guess one of the things that is so, I think, cool about Buddhism, but also perhaps misunderstood, is that every one of the teachings is a medicine for a particular ill. So I could see, you know, when he's talking about this way that we're always kind of looking outside ourselves for definition and trying to measure our lives through comparison and whatever, that, you know, this message, you know, what was it like, the self has nothing to do with others, you know, is the teaching that we need in that moment. And then when you're caught in your self-absorption and your selfishness, then, you know, the teaching would be the self has everything to do with others. You know, it's like, I don't know, like both are true. Hmm. Does anybody else want to chime in about that? Because I definitely agree, Franklin, that's like breaks a lot of rules, even Buddhist rules, in a way.
Well, when we give to others and it's a part of our rituals, it's a part of our life, it's pretty much for the sake of giving without expecting anything in return, right? And so with that in mind, that means that it has nothing to do with yourself. It is for doing the act alone. Hmm. Therefore, trading, bartering, exchange with people. And then that again has nothing to do with yourself. Hmm. So I'm not actually seeing any contradiction there at all.
Well, I'm thinking about his little drawing of like, of the person in the circle. So first of all, he has drawings of people with the little lines between them saying, we can't exchange so much as a fart with another person. talks a lot about farts. And then he says, but we can communicate by language. So we have this, all this kind of superficial exchange.
Yeah.
But we're creating this reality. And it just occurs to me when you're talking about that, Sri, that like, if we are giving with a concept of self and other, I have to do something for others, that, and we're creating that separation. And the way we're living in that world of that kind of superficial world of ideas and discrimination, that kind of exchange. Whereas I could see that self in the circle, like it's all by itself, but it has all these little arrows out. Like it's, the self is not separate from others, from the gift, from any of that, I guess. So they're in a way that, like, we talk about the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift. There really is not, you know, these things actually don't exist in a separate way. So I guess it's pointing toward that, that those differences don't actually exist. And of course, in another way, they do. In the relative sense, they do. Any other observations before our parts that you liked, or questions before I dive in?
I think, sorry.
Go ahead. Oh, you just muted yourself again.
Yeah. Language itself, especially English, an old colonial devised language, can in itself be a trap, but really I don't see a contradiction in that. And sometimes the presentation of Buddhism is metaphor when it needs to be in one aspect of it, but language itself is a separator, isolator.
Yeah,
I have
you.
To completely agree with Ruthann here.
So Uchiyama, he has these cute little drawings of the, you know, you can't exchange anything, but then we have this communication, and we have this world of exchange that we create. So it's really a world of language and concepts that we share, and we have a sense that we're really sharing something real, something in common. And then he says, because of this, we envision that we're born onto like a stage, and each of us is a new member of the cast as we come onto the stage, and then a little drama plays out on the stage. He says, the mistake is that although there is only a partial or superficial communication going on between people, this is on page 42 if you'd like to follow along, we throw our lives completely into that, failing to see ourselves as anything more than members of that world, that stage, that kind of world that we create through our language. The Buddha Dharma corrects this mistaken worldview and reveals a whole different realm. Buddhist teachings focus on our absolute self and place the greatest emphasis on the unique and fresh quality of life. This is part that already been read. Just what is the fresh and vibrant quality of the life of this absolute self? One thing we can be sure of is that we will never discover it in the world of trading and exchanging with others. The true self has nothing to do with others. It is a self that lives totally within itself. The world as experienced is the world which the self alone, you alone, can experience. So last week we were talking about the true self and kind of brainstorming on our whiteboard And one of the themes that came out was people were saying, when I'm most in touch with my true self, there are no words. There is no sense of separation or self. I'm just completely present, directly experiencing. We're experiencing without dependence on preconceived notions. It's not so much that thoughts don't come into our head, but we're not primarily focused, as he said, in this world of exchange and ideas. And the sense also that this true self is deeper and larger than the details of our individual characteristics, relationships, personality, all the things that we, in a conventional sense, help define ourself. But this true self isn't dependent on any of that. So this chapter is about our relationship to the world, and how basically we're simultaneously completely alone and completely connected and interdependent. So in our aloneness, in the reality where we can't exchange so much as a fart with another person, the radical thing is realizing that reality is complete in and of itself. So I don't know about you, but I had a real sense at a certain point in my life before practice of feeling very constricted and limited by self. Not myself in particular as opposed to yourself, but just being this individual person who can never really understand what's going on in another person's mind, right? Never really, we can communicate via language, but never really share the reality of our experience. And even if we try, that's just one little piece. It's not all day. I mean, we have this whole reality that we live that is really ours alone. And if you think of it as a kind of isolated thing, it can be kind of depressing in a way, thinking that this is all there is, kind of aloneness as opposed to interdependence or connection. But in the reality which the Buddhist teachings point us toward, and that through our practice, through our meditation, we find ourselves getting more familiar with, is that there is in that aloneness, we cannot, this is also in Genjo Koan, when Dogen talks about the, no matter how far the fish swims, it cannot reach the end of the water. No matter how far the bird flies, it cannot reach the end of the sky. No matter how hard we try, we cannot get out of our own body and mind. It just can't do it. Nonetheless, this reflects everything. Like the boundary is not what we think. When we sit and meditate and we hear the bird song is self. So this is what he's saying. Everything we encounter, every single part of our experience is part of self. I mean, and he says everything we encounter is our life, but he also throws self in here a lot too. Self with a capital S. If we just think we're born on that stage of life, become one of the players. Everything is about exchange and comparison. We may be a winner, we may be a loser. It's great if we're a winner for a while, but then we always are aware that we might at some point become a loser. We're always at that risk. Language, words, and communication have their utility and beauty, as we've discussed in some of the past classes. But they are about definition, discrimination, the relative. And he's talking about the absolute self. The absolute self, which has no boundaries and is interdependent with everything. It arises, you know, like we've talked about before, in some ways, emptiness is just boundlessness. Emptiness is not being able to carve off and divide something and have it be inherently something unto itself. Where we have in our bodies the result of evolution. We have DNA and red blood cells, and we have processes going on in our body right now that we have, it's nothing to do with our sense of small self. Our body reflects the reality of gravity. It reflects the fact that our planet has a sun that's just the right distance away. We reflect the universe, essentially. So there is even in the aloneness, there is a non-separation and a completeness. So he says in that little diagram of the person with the little arrows, you and the totality of the world you live in together constitute that which I have been calling the life of the self, with a capital S. And I similarly highlighted that phrase, that section. The world is not some entity which exists apart from us. The world is where we function. Likewise, the life of the true self is not some entity apart from our functioning and working. Everything we encounter is our life. So this raises the question, in what way do we think? Some of the things I encounter are not my life. The very name of this chapter, the very point that he's making, suggests that sometimes we go, some of the things I encounter are not my life. I'm not. And what does that, I mean, here's some examples. Moments of dullness and drowsiness in zazen. That when he says, everything you encounter is your life. Moments of anger, moments of judgment, unfulfilled intentions, broken vows, unfulfilled dreams. Everything I encounter is my life. Troubled relationships, living in a time of pandemic, living in a time of political turmoil, uncertainty, global heating. So what do we think, what is going on when we identify something as being part of the life of the self with a capital S versus when we don't? That's not part of the life of the self, or I certainly don't want it to be part of the life of the self. I'm not recognizing it and embracing it in that way. So this made me think of a story which some of you will have heard. So the Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as living a pure life. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered she was with child. This made her parents very angry. She would not confess who the man was, but after much harassment, at last named Hakuin. In great anger, the parents went to the master. "Is that so?" was all he would say. After the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him, but he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else the little one needed. 1 year later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. She told her parents the truth, that the real father was the child of a young man who worked in the fish market. the mother and child, father of the girl, at once went to Hakuin to ask his forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the child back again. Hakuin was willing. In yielding the child, all he said was, "Is that so?" So I'm trying to put myself into Hakuin's place. To be accused of something that you didn't do, to have your reputation destroyed, to have your life upended with a responsibility you never ever intended to take on. And then, I can imagine, after a year, becoming rather attached to this little child. But then the child is taken away. And I don't think this is an argument for passivity. I guess if we look at this in terms of, if we really try to look at it as Hakuin essentially had no choice in these matters, what we're looking at is his attitude. Everything we encounter is our life. Everything is part of the landscape of our life, which is short and precious. So this is the Zen take on the practice of giving up desire in order to liberate ourselves from dukkha. It's a different, we don't use necessarily the same words typically, although we'll talk about dukkha, but dukkha is dissatisfactoriness. So whichever works for you, giving up resistance, giving up desire for things to be any other way than how they are, that's kind of one approach. But there's also more of a positive approach, I guess, is one way you could look at it in terms of making a practice of embracing everything you encounter. So it's the same thing, right? It's giving up your desire for things to be other than how they are, to embrace how they are as not necessarily as something that you like, not necessarily as something you're not going to do anything about, but as your life. This is it. So liberation is not, it's not tapping into some transcendent reality that supersedes the self. It's not leaving this life, this body, going off into some ethereal way of being. Liberation is fully embodied right here in your exact life, your exact self, your exact circumstances. I know that I was miserable before practice, and I had no particular reason to be. My life was fine, outwardly, but it wasn't the way that I thought it should be somehow. I didn't even have a clear idea of how I thought it should be. Not this way. Not this. This wasn't it. And it's been a, 25-year path. Slowly but surely, waking up to everything I encounter is it. Everything I encounter is my life. This is, as keeps coming back to me, the book that we just read by Thich Nhat Hanh, where he says, at each moment we can walk in the kingdom of God. At every moment. Liberation, enlightenment, doesn't happen to people who are different than we are. happens to people just like us. Same gritty circumstances. So, figure we do 10-minute breakout on this question. How do you practice radical acceptance of yourself just as you are, or your life just as it is, or the world just as it is? Sometimes our resistance doesn't necessarily even have something to do with how we feel about ourselves or how we feel about our personal lives. Sometimes our resistance has to do with the world being so screwed up, frankly. Complete liberation or peace can't happen in a world like this. So I'm imagining there's some wisdom out there about what you have done, what you do to work on acceptance and seeing that everything you encounter is your life. It looks like we can just use the same rooms we did before. Okay. So any interesting things anybody wants to share that they heard or thought of in those groups? We talked in a part about not just kind of rejecting or refusing to accept, but also those times in our lives where we just kind of check out because this part doesn't count. We think.
This part doesn't count?
Well, that's what we're thinking when we kind of check out at certain times in our life. You know, we're on our way somewhere, we're working on a task that just needs to get, we think of it as just something we have to get through.
So this is totally like doing whatever you want and then going to the confession box and saying, "What's up, Jesus? Thanks a lot." That's what it sounds like.
Well, we're supposed to, I tried to make it positive, right? How do we accept things? So I guess we talked about that, but the question was, you know, what are things that you do to accept your life? So we sometimes think practice is about improving our lives or the world, or that the fully liberated life would look different than the one that we have. But practice is about inhabiting exactly the life that we have. Can we walk in the kingdom of God, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, in a world, you know, where there's the kind of injustice and destruction and inequality and suffering that's in our world right now? Certainly the teaching says, no matter our circumstances, no matter the state of the world, no matter the state of our personal lives, no matter the state of our practice or ourselves, perfect liberation and peace is accessible to us at every moment when we embrace everything we encounter as our life, to use Nichiyama's term. So I'll end with a piece here. Earlier I mentioned the role of the tenzo is to prepare the meals for the community. Page 44, if you like to follow along. If we see this job of cooking in the ordinary sense, that is, as being just one occupation in society, then the tenzo becomes nothing more than an ordinary cook. Or in a broader context, if being born into the world assumes no more importance than to appear on stage as another member of society, then the meaning of life stops there. However, the function of the tenzo, expressing the Buddha Dharma in terms of living out the vivid and dynamic quality of his life, lives as a total self in whatever circumstances might arise. As long as this self is identical with its world, when we function in the role of tenzo or anything else, this functioning becomes the life of the self. At the same time, this is the dojo or practice hall where we practice living the universal self. The universal self with a capital S. So, comments or questions or,
muted. I think one problem we might have with the term acceptance is that it is related to, possibly, or similar to approval. Mm. You can accept the reality of the situation without approving. Mm. But if you accept the reality of the situation, you're much more capable of dealing with it. And I think the coronavirus is a good example of that. Those that have denied it, who do not accept it, do not understand what it is, have gone, and many of them have died. I mean, there's been a number of ministers who railed against it and had services, even though when it was apparent that it was a bad idea, and their congregations and they themselves have died. So that's not accepting the reality of the situation. Mm. If you accept the reality of the situation, you accept it, you can deal with it. Then you can start to develop an understanding and a way to deal with it, whether to make the effort to change it or just to let it be, because either it's not that important, it's just an irritant in your life, or it can't be changed and you best move on to other things that you can affect.
Go ahead, Mark, you're still, there you go.
I'm just reminded of the Tibetan wisdom of facing your fears and, you know, looking reality hard, you know, facing reality as it is doesn't mean to, I'm agreeing with, sorry, with what, Garth, is it Gathel? Has just said.
Gathel.
Yeah, sorry, Gathel. It's not approving of the world the way it is, but truly looking at it, seeing it, facing it, and seeing it for what it is. Mm. And bearing witness and then acting. That's what I see, what radical acceptance as being. And the courage required is to actually face it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Thank you.
And see it as myself as well. Yeah, to see it as me as well, not separate from it. Yeah.
Tree?
I was just going to say that a lot of issues people have with accepting a new situation is that they're not themselves anymore. The themselves that they know and love and are proud of, that person can no longer exist. That we have to redefine what success is in this new life. We have to redefine productivity in this new life, or health, or whatever, because our priorities have changed. And because our priorities have changed, some people have lost, you know, jobs, some people have lost people. You just have to roll with it in terms of, okay, reshift your priorities, your resources, and then see where you stand. You'll still be proud of that person. So that's how I shift with my weird situations.
That's a great point.
For me, I'm finding that with all this extra time where I don't have to go places and, you know, I just stay home. No travel, all that stuff. I have more time to reflect and therefore accept what I see and what I was around me and what is in me, within me. I have seen myself change a lot from when it first happened. I just wanted to be with family on the East Coast. I really wanted to. I even had fantasies of going back to my first husband, who I married in the 70s. And, you know, we're still in touch. And I realized, well, it's not about him. It is about him, but I don't know. I just wanted escape and comfort and something like that. I finally moved past that, but I also had I wanted to go back and be with the rest of my family out there. Again, I've moved past that too, but I don't know, I think it was scary. I just wanted to huddle with my family. Now it's just me and my husband here, and we're okay. And our pets.
I think Sri has a good point about how it's like we're creatures of narrative, even if, like, you know, we're supposed to not be attached to our stories and see past our stories and all that. But we're also creatures of stories. That's how we navigate the world. It's how we make sense of the world. So in a way, we always have a story. We just think a little bit more about, you know, what kind of story do we want to have? And is it going to be grounded in reality? So it's like the story I had of my life and the life of our Zen Center, you know, went on this particular trajectory. And now it looks like, how much is that trajectory going to change? I mean, even best case scenario, it's definitely a 6 month digression, right? So, yeah, absorbing that and recognizing in what way it ourself is that little being like interdependent with everything around us, then all of this is part of us. All of this is inevitably affecting us and changing us. And are we gonna fight that and be miserable about it, or are we gonna, you know? I guess that I just, you know, in terms of that, like, how do you help yourself accept? I guess sometimes I think about my life as you might have heard me say this before, but like as a book or a movie, like, you know, there's a narrative. If I step out and, you know, I try to imagine from the outside a character in a book being like, I don't want to be this character. I don't want these circumstances. But from the outside, you see, you know, what? That makes no sense. This is the arc. This is the story. These are the circumstances. This is what makes it interesting. This what the conflict is what, you know, people learn from. This is what makes it exciting. Internally, we may fight it from the outside. This is our deal. As far as we know, we're not going to get another one. All right. Well, that brings us to about 9 o'clock. So I will just close with a verse of dedication. We offer the merit of our practice to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for spending your evening together.
Good night, everyone.
Night.
Good night. Take care.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Bye. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye, Vanush.